Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi folks, this is Chris, not Mark, for once. As you'll hear on today's episode, learning about this band from the web isn't always the easiest task. We tried our best to contact the band to clear up some of the finer details, but alas, we didn't actually hear back until after the recording. So there are a few gaps in our knowledge on this show. Just want to say thanks to Stoffel, Tore and Manuel, I think it's pronounced Tore. The current members of Ecopsy, and maybe one day we'll even get a chance to hear from them directly. Anyway, enjoy the show.
Hey folks, it's the Unsung Podcast. I'm Mark, got a sore tongue. I bit it really hard yesterday, but it's falling off. I'm with Chris. Hi Chris.
Hiya Mark. You know, if you think our accents are normally hard to follow, we decided to really throw the gauntlet down by inviting our friend Joe McGlynn on the pod.
I can't help, like, this is the way I usually talk, so I can't help it when somebody else talks like me, comes on to the show.
Well, see, Joe is the most Scottish-accented podcaster I know, and I've got a feeling that it's probably, by the end of this, going to make us talk with a stronger accent, because I do that. I just, when I'm playing football, I talk a bit more like that. Geez, a bar.
You simulate.
Joe, he's a bit here.
Hello, how you doing? All right.
There it is. It's called code shifting, by the way. That's
called govern, mate.
That's it. Govern, hang on. That's what I work now.
No joy.
No joy.
No joy.
We have a couple of people that have written to us in the past saying they listen to the podcast because it helps them practice their English and dealing with accents.
Fucking cheeky bastards, man.
This is an educational episode. This is like your end of term assessment for this year.
And it's quite apt that it's come for this band as well.
Yeah, because we're about to analyse some incomprehensible music.
Yeah.
This was my choice this week. We are going to do Tans Grozny Tans by the band Ecopsy. Now, before we get to that, we've got some admin, Mark.
Yeah, I need a new battery for my car.
So anybody that's been tuned in to the serial dramatisation of Mark's life will know.
I think public transport here again.
Yeah, it wasn't his alternator, but his battery was gubbed. And now he has been forced against his will to get a racist to do the work on his car.
Yes.
You got a racist mechanic?
He's a family friend, so I didn't want to give him the business this time. I explained this before we came on air, but unlikely he's listening to this podcast. Really, very unlikely. But basically, he went to school with my mum. He's pretty cheap, and he always takes care of me because he knows my mum and doesn't want me to die. Basically, right? which is pretty sweet.
Unless you're cold, obviously.
Unless you're cold, or have ever had COVID. He's never had COVID. He's always only ever had the flu. He's never had COVID.
It doesn't exist, mate.
Despite the fact he was in hospital.
We COVID.
So there you go. Mark, financing extremism. There you go.
I mean, I didn't want him to do the work in my car. My MOT's due, right? But my battery died and he was the only person that could jump me. So I had to get him involved. And
you had to get Combat 18 on the phone.
I had to basically, I so.
What's the special? Dial 0800.
Nazi.
HH.
1939.
It's just that kind of casually racist with a lot of older folk are.
You know what I mean?
Like, he's not actually, I don't think he's an actual, maybe he is an actual racist. I don't know. I just know that he's pure brain damage.
That generation, aye. I've got a guy that does my tiles who's exactly the same. Just fix my fucking tiles.
Yeah, just get it done, mate.
If you've never been to Glasgow, might we recommend you sample our local taxi drivers. Taxi drivers are colourful across the world, but the good thing about Glasgow is that a lot of taxi drivers are absolutely sound as fuck.
Oh, I bet.
Some of them are service industry.
Some of them are absolutely mental. So,
yeah. I've got a crank. Well, it's not racist, one right enough. Was like, I'll just tell you because I fucking started now. This was in the mid 90s, and me and my mates were going into Glasgow for a night out. So I was about maybe 18 at the time or something like that. And kind of this taxi, and the guy's got the tunes blaring and stuff like that. And then I looked in, he's got this big, like, a big sack with like coins in it. And I just was like that. Says, what's with the coins?
Guy's got a big sack. This is like fake taxi.
And he's like, I use it if anybody gives me any shite. I just fucking smashed him in the face with it. I was like, all right, mate, we'll just pay you the now then. There you go. Aye.
Wow. Yeah, come and check it out.
Yeah.
It's our little public service announcement for the Glasgow tourists.
More seriously, you don't like adverts. That's the gambit I'm going with. You don't like adverts.
Yeah, what if your mechanic's in the adverts?
If he's got that much money, I'd actually give him money.
What if you're financing your own adverts via right-wing terrorists?
It's more likely to be ScotRail.
So. I would probably rather give it to right-wing terrorists than ScotRail.
Six and a half a dozen in it, really.
But you have a Patreon, which means you can get access to our episodes ad-free if you give us £4 a month or whatever the equivalent local currency is. With that, you also get access to episodes a couple of days early, and you also get access to a Facebook group if you still use Facebook, which increasingly people of our age are not doing. But if you are one of those people that's still left on that platform, then yeah.
Yeah, the AAA group is pretty lively, and you get to input onto the content of episodes and challenges directly on some of the stupid shit that we come out with.
Or even better than that,
how about you go up from $4 and you decide, I'm going to give these guys £15 a month, and £15 a month is probably something like 20 pence an hour based on what we put into this show.
That's still pretty good.
But you get from that, you get to be a member of the Digital Record Club, the Unsung Record Club, and we will send you once a month some specially curated albums by, well, some of them are actually bands that we cover. Others are some of the many very, very cool underground acts that we come across on our travels, and the money goes to support us, but also goes directly to these bands and artists, because we buy the music from them or from their labels directly, and they're all sort of independent labels and musicians. So you're supporting the entire ecosystem of music by doing that, and you're getting new tunes in your ears. It arrives, it's a little present, you don't know what it is, you download it and you're like, oh, whoa, there we go. That's enough selling for today, because today we're very much on the topic of not capitalism.
Aye.
So yeah, we're doing a band called Yacopsy. The name is written a whole host of different ways, but the way that I have most commonly seen it written is Yacopsae.
Aye, when the E and the A is kind of joined.
Yeah, so they've got the O with the slash through it, they've got the A and E joined together. We'll get on to how they arrived at that sound.
That's what those letters are.
I have spent much of this week trying to remember how the fuck I found out about Yacopsy. I honestly don't remember. Don't know. I did only recently learn that they were still going, because the album we're going to talk about today is from 2007. They go all the way back to the early 90s. But I was in Hamburg not so long ago and noticed a poster for them stuck on a wall. By the way, have you ever been to Hamburg?
I have.
Really want to go.
I played played shows over there. Eh?
So they have this fly postering technique where they like stick posters on posters on posters on posters till it's like literally like maybe inches thick and all peeling and flaking away. It's a really cool look. So it's a bit of tourism for Hamburg as well.
There we go.
But I saw a Ucopsy poster when I was cutting about there. I was like, Jesus, those guys are still going. And it reminded me just how much I fucking like this band.
Yeah.
And I was like, they are going to be one of the most perfect examples of a subject that we could do on this show in my book, because they're incredibly underground.
That's a feature. Not,
yeah,
not
I mean, so Unsung Pod, yeah, we have in the past covered stuff like, you know, we covered Nine Inch Nails from the perspective of, yes, this album is celebrated, but it's not celebrated enough. We've covered other big bands, but we've covered perhaps the dismissed album by that band. But no, this week we are covering a genuinely underground, very underrepresented band that I think a lot of you will like. It's probably the closest I can think of to that acute definition of this show since probably Train Dodge. Remember Train Dodge that Fritz brought to the table?
Yeah.
American underground band. So yeah, that name is Ucopsy, which by the way is the same as saying Jacobs, the plural of the name Jacob, as in like the surname, you know, Mark Jacobs, the designer. And it turns out that the band's name is indeed from a surname. I'll have cut a sample in here. And one obvious question is, what is this mad fucking racket? That's one of the reasons that our man Joe is here, because Joe is good at helping to discern some of the more extreme sounds in the spectrum, courtesy of many years in different bands. Joe, some of your bands?
I don't know. Man Must Die is probably the most, obviously, popular, if you like.
It's the one that gave you all the anecdotes, isn't it?
That's the one that everybody says that's Joe from. Fucking hate that band. Anyway, Man Must Die, currently playing a kind of old school kind of hardcore band called Go Down Fighting. I played in a band called Visor with Craig from a band called Aerogram. Did an EP with him. Side Effects was my first band, but I kind of like that. I sent you guys that earlier. We were like a really, really aggro kind of like hardcore band.
Very lo-fi.
Kind of jokey kind of stuff. And loads of other wee daft things that don't really matter.
So you're here to partly help us disambiguate terms like power violence and grindcore. So these are terms that have been used in reference to this band. I should point out that Stoffel from this band has done a number of interviews. He was doing one with Noise magazine, and he said, I want to observe that we hate to be labelled as grindcore.
What do
we say they are?
We'll get into that. Yeah.
What do they say they are? Yeah, I mean, like first impressions, I mean, from the discussions we had, I didn't want to think of them as power violence because there's something weirdly jock about that I don't want this band to be. But yet from the description that I was reading, especially when it comes to the vocal register, I was like, maybe that is the closest.
Yeah.
Probably. Well, I don't know.
What would be your rule of thumb difference between grindcore and power violence, Joe?
Probably the vocals, because in grind it's usually a lot like growler, like Barney for Napalm Death. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Or Kevin Sharp for Brutal Truth. Still not fast enough. You know what I mean? Those guys are really like kind of like that kind of shit.
Yeah.
Then obviously bands a wee bit later on, like kind of you've got like Mama Kill, and I suppose you can maybe see the Red Chord a wee bit, but they've got that sort of vocal delivery. But aye, the Power Violence tends to be more the traditional kind of, it's the next step up for like your Minor Threat type yelling. Mm-hmm. all your minor threats type stuff, your discharge type stuff, you can actually hear what they're saying. Mm-hmm. But the difference between that extreme hardcore going into power violence is that's when the vocals really become undiscernible. You can't really hear really what they're saying. They're just going full bore, and right. It's usually in a screechy kind
of vocal. But it's not at that kind of like register of the likes of like black metal.
No, black metal took that to me. That just sounds fucking funny. That doesn't sound intense. Yeah. Whereas these guys sound like there's no technique used, pretty much. You know what I mean? They're just fucking like they were shouting at somebody in the street, like full on.
Yeah, that's kind of it. Because I mean, I'm saying black metal. There are like, I mean, we did the early Mayhem stuff, for example, when it's a bit punkier and stuff.
Definitely.
High register doesn't always need to be used in the sort of context of that very grandiose black metal sort of stuff. You can hear it used with really, really grindy music.
Early Napalm Death. I mean, Mitch Harris, their guitar player in Napalm Death, he joined kind of in the late 80s. When he joined, Napalm had a two vocal thing happening. So Barney did the kind of and Mitch did the they used to call it the Japanese scream, because I think the Japanese were the first to really take that kind of hardcore. But it's like that.
Yeah.
It's like full on distortion. So he was doing that back then. He was doing that kind of that kind of thing. Do you know what I mean?
So I will say, like, where the vocals in Yakopsy are pitched is kind of where I like them.
It's the exact same as Todd from Nails. It's the exact same vocal register.
Mm-hmm. He changed it up the way, because in their first couple of records, it's Silent Death, and then the one after it, his vocals are more that kind of and then he did that last one, You'll Never Be One of Us, and his vocals were deeper. He almost went for that kind of power violence vibe to more of a kind of grindcore vocal.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
So to the untrained ear, and I actually very much think I am technically the untrained ear, even though I have a passing familiarity with a lot of this stuff, it can be difficult to to find the nuance in some of this music. But we're going to do our best to bring it, because I mean, it is intense sonically. It's very hard hitting, and it takes a while before you can start to see the distinctions. You know, that's that whole kind of old adage about, oh, it just sounds the same. Well, it doesn't sound the same, but it's fair enough that at first blush it does often sound quite similar. For the record, in a 2002 interview with Noise Attack, Emu, the drummer, called them fastcore.
That makes
which
sense.
I think is kind of like a playful way to try and to sidestep some of the various connotations of grindcore.
I think
power violence.
I think with grindcore as well, it's like there's a lot of offshoots. So there's a lot of really crap offshoots, gore grind and all that, and
porno grind,
all that fucking shit.
So we did an episode on Pig Destroyer, who'll probably get a mention in this later on as well, and in that episode we sort of went through these sub-genres of grindcore. Please go back, check that out if you want. It's going to be punishing, but it was quite a good episode. The basics in this band, so they're currently a trio, as we say, from Hamburg in Germany, but they began as a duo in 1990. Stoffel, who's still in the band, met the original drummer Patix in a Hamburg squat. We will put a pin in the phrase squat and we'll come back to that. Patix left apparently due to musical differences in 1992 and was replaced, and they added a bassist in 1996. So as we say, Yakopsy are still going strong. They're far from impossible to find online, but they're definitely not a band that lives online. They seem to have maybe tried to adapt to the online world, bearing in mind this band came together in the 1990s, when the internet literally was not a widespread thing whatsoever. But equally, it's just not a world that they came from. So when you see their stuff, it has that sort of GeoCities kind of slightly bunch of older guys trying to like do a website kind of vibe to it. And I don't mean to be patronising, because
that's part of the charm, isn't it?
I'm on that, and that's the charm. Yeah. So researching the group is definitely not impossible, but it's not really our typical routine, Mark, when we're, you know, there's certain places we can go to normally that we're like, right, this will, we'll get this there and this there. And so their catalogue, for example, is incredibly fragmented, so we're going to try and navigate that a wee bit soon as well.
It seems to be up fairly comprehensive on Discogs and but your music or catalogue.
It's okay on Discogs. There's stuff missing on Discogs, but there's then stuff on Discogs that is not even official, that doesn't technically exist. So yeah, we'll get to that.
But like, as you said, their own website, they seem to also be, this is kind of the part of the DIY hardcore punk thing, the whole Discord kind of ethos is like, well, fundamentally, Ian MacKay is an archivist, and they seem to be quite good at archiving their own,
yeah,
their own like interviews and appearances and places, and some lyrics, not all lyrics, some lyrics, you know. So they've made it a lot easier than a lot of other bands could, because they seem to actually care about tracking their own history.
Yeah, that's true
as well.
That's, you know, true. I mean, as I said, I don't recall how I came across them. I really don't. When I first heard them, I was really into a couple of the records in particular, including this one. And when I bought the LP for Tans Grisny Tans, it was effectively the modern version of an old mail order. Mail order, especially in the kind of extremes of like punk and grind and things like that, used to happen through zines a lot. You'd have literally just a list of records that this label had, and you would write off to them. So I ended up writing to a guy in the Czech Republic using like Google Translate, and eventually got it posted out. It took about 4 weeks to arrive, and I have to admit, it was actually kind of exciting compared to, you know, the Amazon method. You know, it was old school. It was quite rewarding when it arrived. I'd sort of half forgotten that I'd ordered it, and then it landed, and I was like, fucking yes. Yeah. And it gives you like a bit of like, I've got this LP and it's actually kind of special, because I had to work pretty hard to get it.
Actually get it.
Yeah. I did reach out to the band for a wee bit of detail. I would say that I didn't really get anywhere, but actually this afternoon I got a reply via Facebook, of all places. And in the reply, they were just like, oh yeah, sorry, we don't check this very often, but we'll get back to you soon. Didn't really get a chance to say, we're recording tonight. So unfortunately, the band are not going to be part of the show. I would have liked to have had maybe some voice notes and some explanations from them. However, I'll explain shortly. We're probably going to do a sort of follow-up to this on a related subject. And
we a can sequel?
Yeah, a sequel of sorts. And we can maybe loop them in on that one. So what I'm going to have to do is refer to a number of the interviews that they've given to fanzines and the odd magazine. Luckily, as Mark says, they're reasonably good at archiving some of that stuff. It is also interesting that one of those interviews for Noise magazine in 2009 starts with an exchange about them refusing written interviews because they were like fed up repeating themselves, and they were also disillusioned with the outcome and the, you know, the benefits of many hours spent writing answers to these long emailed interviews. They just got kind of scunnered with it. Their origins and their early influences. So, again, referring to some of these interviews, Stoffel speaking to Short, Fast and Loud zine, issue 25 in 2011, says, Jakobsi, I won't do this in a German accent, although it did cross my mind. Jakobsi has been formed more or less accidentally back in early summer 1990. We were located in the eastern suburbs of Hamburg, and at this point of time, some hyperactive parts of our local punk left wing scene squatted successfully several houses in this area. One of the squatters was Patex, our first drummer. So one fine day I was visiting some friends in a new squatted building, and they introduced me to him while he was painting his new room. We talked about different things, and both of us had no musical activities at the time. And then he continues, a short time after we'd met each other, Patex and I went to the rehearsal room of his group, the DDLs, based in a Catholic youth centre. Prior to that, we tried to convince several friends to join the band because we had nobody for the vocals and no one for the bass guitar as well. But obviously, we had no success, and so I became a shouter while shredding the strings. Mm-hmm. Actually, from the start, I just wanted to play the guitar, nothing more, nothing less, because I hate my voice, even today. Patex was more blessed, he just needed to play the drums. Nevertheless, somehow it worked, and we created our first noisy short tunes without bass, heavily inspired by other bassless two-piece bands such as Satanic Malfunctions and Active Minds. Active Minds, a band that actually got over here quite often. I mean, we were talking about 13th Note before we started recording. Remember seeing them there?
Aye.
Within the following months, this is me and my non-German again. Within the following months, we still had no idea for a name. Although at one point, a friend of Patek's, the vocalist of the DDL, showed up to watch our rehearsals. While making jokes about using somebody's name for the band, we'd taken his surname, Jacobs, turned it into the plural form, Jacobse. There you go. We changed some letters because it looked cool and it's kind of an old tradition in German punk. Later I'd draw that logo. We were so happy about having a name and we used the photograph of Jacobs as a cover for our very first demo. On the other hand, the first time when people heard our name, they thought we would play some fun punk because the pronunciation sounds so sweet. But at last, we always were able to prove them that black is white. Mm-hmm. We never ever had the intention to have a brutal name. He just finishes that bit by saying, we rehearsed almost half a year and did our very first show at a birthday party in a local youth centre. Mm-hmm. It was the middle of January 1991. Mm-hmm. Kind of adorable. But I think right early on, you know, you hear this band and you're like, they're called Bloodthirsty Hellripper or something like
that. Aye.
They're not. Mm-hmm. They're not. They've got this very neutral name. And he's saying that even in the early days on that scene, they were like, why do you have such a, like a pop punk name?
Aye.
That's kind of nice, isn't it?
It is, it's kind of, it's no pretentious and it's no kind of feeding into that, you know, I play extreme music so my band name needs to be extreme as well because that kind of
exactly.
Shite that.
In terms of the early influences, yeah, all their interviews are strewn with band names, especially
I noticed as time goes on.
Oh, they always put them in all caps as well.
I was like, because my missus looked at my phone when I was reading and she's like, what the fuck is that code?
Exactly, like, yeah. It's like total gobbledygook. But yeah, they regularly promote both their influences and their peers. But in terms of the early days, Stoffel said in an interview, Patek's and I got into the whole punk thing in the early 1980s, around 81, 82, including the classics such as Sex Pistols, Ramones, Black Flag, The Dickies, Dead Kennedys, Subhumans, the UK Subhumans. Generation X, 999, Adam and the Ants, etc. Patek's used to play guitar in a shitty band called the DDLs, mm-hmm. producing really crappy covers of early 80s punk rock from Germany, and my own previous band, SD Jesus, made dark mm-hmm. and melancholy punk, something between the early Jesus and Mary Chain, the Smart Pills, and Exmal Deutschland. Exmal Deutschland, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Both of us were unsatisfied with the musical direction of these bands, so we said, let's try something new. The drummer, Emu, who came in 92, he was speaking to Noise Attack Scene in an interview, and he said, I personally, I could do this in a different German accent. Mm. Imagine this is a different voice. maybe he's bigger. I personally like music with heavy, distorted bass and guitar, fast drums and breaks, and I like chaotic stuff with distortions and all that weird stuff. Drum machines can be funny, but only when they are insanely fast. I don't like the usage of synthesizers and other computer stuff, except for making a few effects, and of course for recording the whole crap. So my faves are bands which make music with sweat and the usage of their brains. I played in a noise band, Tumor, back in 1995, but even if this was pure noise, we made the songs before we recorded them. I think he's like basically saying we weren't just making shit up as we went along.
Aye, aye.
As he points out, it was not only pure noise like so many bands in those years, as in a lot of people just go up in noise bands and literally just fuck around.
Aye, totally.
Yeah, we've had this debate on the show many times. I've had this debate over many episodes of Hacks and Cloak, I believe, Mark. Of course, we all love pop punk, like Weezer and other combos.
I really like Weezer.
I was very taken aback.
It's one and done, isn't it?
It's a recurring theme. I also like when people use the word combos to describe bands, because it mixes lovely tunes and lyrics with hard guitars and nice riffs. Mark, you couldn't have put it better yourself.
I could not have put it better myself.
But recently, I don't listen much music because I have a lot of work to do and no time to put on a record.
That's a German's for you, man. Really efficient.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of inspiration, he adds, we were inspired by old German punk, first grindcore like Napalm Death, metal, and of course, fast stuff like DRI, Dirty Rotten Imbeciles.
Definitely, aye.
He also then laughs about how 10 years ago DRI was considered very fast.
I mean they started, aye. They technically have the first blast beat.
Really? That's right, aye, we did that in that episode.
Christ.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of episodes.
Well, I mean, if we're really going to get down to the nitty gritty, it's Billy Joel.
Really?
I'm not even joking, aye, Billy Joel. He was in a prog rock band called Attila.
I've heard the name Attila.
Aye, he did an album, right? And there's a song on it. It's, if you YouTube it, you'll find it.
I mean, I'm gonna have to fucking add it.
And there's a bit in it, like it's a full on blast beat, and it's tight. It's an alternate blast. So it's like, and it goes on for maybe about a full bar over the music. It's a blast beat.
There you go.
There you go. Billy Joel.
What speed was it though? Like BPM?
Fast, man. It's quick, guy. Yeah. It's rapid, aye. Whereas the guy's obviously a jazz drummer.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
So yeah, you might remember that earlier on we put a pin in the term squats. So let's go back to that for a wee minute. I'd actually planned to do a fair bit on squats. I'd said to you guys when we came to this subject, I'd like to use it as a bit of a window onto that whole world. But to be honest, I realised as I was doing that the subject deserves its own show. And so I think that's what we'll do. I'm saying about doing a kind of companion piece to this. I think at some point in the near future we'll come back and we'll do a proper episode about the squat scene. What is the squat scene? Mm. What are like those kind of NFA, no fixed abode touring bands that are just constantly on the road? What the fuck is that? Because I guarantee you, especially if you're not in a touring band or a band at all, the world of squats might seem a really long way away from you. I mean, especially in the UK as well, where it's less of a thing. So this would hopefully include some interviews, some proper insight from, you know, lifers in that world, because it tends to be a way of life kind of approach. But we will skim the subject here quickly, because it forms quite a lot of the backdrop. You know, not just the backdrop to the formation of Ecopsy, because Stoffel was talking about meeting the drummer as he was painting his new squat room, but also the sound of the band and the ethos and the political outlook of the band. A lot of that goes hand in hand in the squat scene. So this is the back of a napkin sketch of squat scene. Squatting abandoned buildings, especially in Europe where the laws are different to the UK, is not just an essential way for some people to address homelessness, but it also creates like these essential community hubs that host everything from language courses, legal advice, you know, workshops, soup kitchens, to things like arts exhibitions, film, music, and especially punk rock for a lot of them. The squatting scene is predominantly a mainstay of the political left, and perhaps due to how those kind of places arise, the spaces are generally quite politicised. Sentiment on the left of that spectrum varies wildly. There's kind of an anarcho-collectivist bent to a lot of those places with efforts to keep the space totally autonomous and self-sustaining, not least because there's also quite often rules whereby they kind of get left to their own devices, but the local authorities will come down on them if they're caught stealing electricity or things like that they're not paying for. And sometimes that can threaten the places with closure, you know, eviction and closure. On the other hand, some of the spaces are much more kind of gently, shall we say, socialist, you know, democratic socialist, operating really more as a kind of typical community hall or social club thing like that. It's also worth mentioning that there do exist right-wing squats. I know from personal experience, especially in Italy, this is sometimes an issue, and also sometimes the squats kind of went to war. There's quite a famous one in I think it's Rome, called Casa Pound. It's a famous right-wing squat, taking its name from Ezra Pound, the poet.
Oh, great.
And likewise, you'd kind of find a fair few right-wing spaces across maybe Eastern and Southeastern Europe, not to mention, you know, all over the globe, you know, Indonesia and Chile and the USA Anybody that's ever seen the film Green Room, you seen that?
Yep.
Yeah.
Right. So if you've seen the movie Green Room, you might have a head start in imagining some of the latter, you know, minus the skinheads and swastikas. Try to kind of hold that in your mind when you're thinking of this. It's a space that kind of exists by its own rules. Maybe it runs its own bar. Quite often, you know, squats will have living space in them, as well as like central function spaces, little offshoot rooms and stuff like that. Bardlock in Brussels is actually one I'm quite familiar with. That's actually got skate ramps built inside the building. That's a really big place. Funnily enough, it's got skate ramps inside the building and it's got toilets outside the building.
Makes perfect sense.
So when you go to Bardlock,
prioritise, man.
It's fucking freezing when you go for a piss. It's like, you know when that thing, and the guy next to you is pissing, but the steam from his piss is coming up in your face.
Yep.
And you know that that's basically evaporated piss.
That's piss you're getting straight into your
you're
nose.
You're just inhaling his piss.
Mm-hmm. You may as well piss up your beak.
It's a big thing in Bardlock. It's also got, you know, that it's got, I think it's got one or maybe even two venues in it. It's got an art gallery in it. It's got this quite a big kitchen for kind of catering almost rather than just cooking. It's also got an entire room covered in mattresses, which sounds kind of cute until you're in the room and you realise that nobody's ever cleaned any of those mattresses. Those mattresses were either donated or found, and they've been added in there. And I remember being invited to stay in that after we'd played there one night. I believe two of the guys did stay in that, and they were just like, that is one of the most bogging experiences. Bless them.
Aye.
Really like the people at Bardlock. Really enjoyed playing it. Fucking cold, but the mattress room, don't go.
We played a squat. We didn't play a squat, but we stayed in a squat, and I think it was in Tilburg. It was, and it was the same deal. It was just like, I need to levitate here. But it was really nice of them to offer it.
Yeah. They had mattresses up the walls, I seem to remember as well, and there was something weirdly,
what, kind of like sleeping up against the wall, standing up or some shit.
It's like you could go like ricocheting around the room without hurting yourself, but also if you screamed, could somebody hear you?
More like that hostel type situation.
So another one I'm familiar with, quite different, Bomberenea in Tolosa in the Basque Country. It's a squatted fire station. Actually, that's where the name Bomberenea comes from. It's basically this beautiful old fire station that the walls outside are glorious. They've painted them all. It's like yellow and blue and red and green. Incredible designs. The whole building has a full garden, like a vegetable garden. It's got chickens, so when you get food there, you know, the eggs, they're all like self-sustaining. So, and some of the bigger squats go even further than that as well. The politics of those kind of spaces in a large way led to the politicised music. You know, it was an obvious fit. And we also need to bear in mind, I think, that a lot of the original kind of diehard punk movement were, you know, no fixed abode. And this squatting was how they lived a lot of the year.
New York scene was like that as well.
Yeah, New York scene was like that. And London as well. I mean, the UK, obviously, crass. Like, are huge names in that. You've got Oipoloi and stuff as well. You've got we will talk about this a lot more in a Scotland episode. There's a lot to pick apart.
Very utopian, isn't it?
Yeah. Idealistic. Didn't always work out well, but then other times it really did. And certainly in Europe, some of them have been around a long time and are really integral to their local communities and to the health of the music scene. Yeah, and as we say, there are bands who've spent years touring without permanent residence, really, just sort of like, can we stay here for a couple of months till the next tour? Just cutting around Eastern Europe for 3 months at a time.
You know, to be honest, like, having no permanent residence and being a band that tours a lot is probably the most cost-effective way to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
It is, aye.
Because you don't need to pay rent in a flat that you're not in for like fucking 200 days of the year.
Yep.
Makes sense, aye.
Yeah, totally. So they would just land. You know, the end of the tour finishes here. Can we get, 6 weeks here? Is that okay? We'll chip in. Then on you go. So yeah, we'll come back to this because I promise you there's a really, really interesting story in squatting and how the music scene formed around it and the left v right in parts of Europe and all that kind of stuff. This isn't the place for it. We'll go back to talking about Ucopsy, okay? So touring, international shows, things like that. Ucopsy are not one of those bands who spend half a year touring, but they have spent a lot of time getting their music out of Germany. Emu, talking to Noise Attack Scene, said, we play about 20 to 30 gigs a year.
That's not a lot at all.
We had some very bad experiences so far, but we don't care about it anymore. We just avoid places who are fucking bullshit or persons who invite us just because we are so fast to impress his or her friends. Stoffel elaborates to the Short, Fast and Loud Scene, our local scene in Hamburg had been very active in doing political things. squatting, anti-fascism, etc. But the bands there were absolutely lazy. They played exclusively in the outlying districts, did a demo tape or two, and that's all. None of them were trying to play outside of Hamburg, getting in touch with bands or fanzines from other cities, countries. It was strange. I guess we were the only band in our area which tried to escape off the Eastern District. We sent tapes to fanzines, traded stuff with bands from other cities to catch up on shows, and so on. And he continues, to be honest, we never really have been that much into real long touring. Of course, we generally like to travel and play live, but we dislike to be on the road for several weeks or months. For example, Drop Dead, band you're a fan of, Joe. Yeah, toured through Europe for half a year. Yeah, I'd say they must be absolutely crazy in my opinion. But that would be way too much for us. We always went on tour for just 1 week or 10 days. That's pretty much enough for us. We even do many short tours for 3 or 4 shows or something comparable. That's more fun, and we're able to play good sets without burning out caused by bad conditions, endless driving, lack of sleep.
Been there.
Yeah, absolutely. To avoid giving the wrong impression, we're often on the road and we've played 21 different countries, and he lists a whole bunch of countries, including like Colombia, Scotland, Turkey, the USA, Ireland.
Seem to have quite a good connection with the scene in Colombia. They talk about that a lot.
I'll just get to that, in fact. Another important point is to have a good partner to tour with. Otherwise, it means nothing but stress in many ways.
True.
So just to touch on that, in terms of these bands that do go on tour for a long time, I've never done anything like months at a time, but I think I've done 5 or 6 weeks. And it's
hardcore.
It can be difficult. You need to schedule well. You need to have days off. You need to maintain your equipment. You need to maintain your own well-being.
Yep. Yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. Your diet.
Sanity.
Yeah. You know, drinking. You know, you hit it hard early on, and then pretty soon you can't fucking stand the sight of it.
And the people you're in the band with.
Yeah. And as you're saying, it depends who you're on tour with.
Totally.
As well. So I've toured with another band, and that actually was a weird cause of friction as well. I mean, the people in my band, we always had learned the dynamic, you know, we kind of worked within our little group, but you suddenly butt up against another band that, for example, just won't eat the local food. And so you spend hours traipsing about trying to find them a fucking McDonald's when you're like, guys, there's great food at the place, can we just eat, you know, that kind of stuff. Those kind of like things can get really irritating. So being on tour with the right person is
100%
really important. Mark, you mentioned the band spent some time in Colombia, pretty good contacts. They travelled to Colombia to play shows, and I've done splits with a few bands for there. They performed, for example, at quite a famous squat, I think it's in Bogota, called Pieso Tres. But they've also teamed up with bands for like Malaysia, Indonesia, Japan, more. So I think it kind of illustrates as well the interconnectedness of these kind of scenes, not just the music scene, you know, the grindcore, the punk scenes, but also the squat scene, that whole mentality, that whole way of life. And that'll be a part of that episode as well when the time comes. Stoffel, by the way, was asked about how they maintain their drive to this day, and he says there can be no talk of drive in this context, because we neither see ourselves as martyrs for or against an important cause, nor are we waving the flag for a select circle such as punk or hardcore. Rather, it's just a close friendship with each other that inspires us to be active, which is...
That's the number one. Aye, that's what it should be.
Yeah.
Aye.
It's nice as well. So it's like a few occasions already. You know, you hear this kind of music and you're like, oh God, these guys are going to be such hard work. And actually pretty early on, you realise, one, we deliberately didn't want a band that was like the usual like gore spitter or whatever the fuck.
Aye.
And then you hear that they're not really out there like boring the tits off you with like sanctimony. They're actually like, we just love playing music together, and yeah, we have some political content in our songs, but it's not why we keep doing it.
Aye, exactly.
Yeah.
And they admit they like pop punk, you know?
You like pop punk, you like Weezer. They're like, no, we don't really want to go on the road because we want to play good shows. You know, when we go and play at your town, we don't want to be burnt out. And
that's quality, shit. Not quantity, you know?
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I touched there on some of the content, some of their, you know, their own politics, the lyrics. The singing in German is quite important, because in Europe especially, you'll notice that a lot of bands who sing in English, I can't blame them for it. It broadens their audience, but it also sometimes gives you a little bit of insight into their aspirations as well.
Yep.
And that's not meant as a criticism, but it, you know, if you're in a band and you're like, we're writing some pretty tasty songs, we should sing these in English because there's a potential
to make it bigger.
They could break through.
Yep.
A lot of Swedish bands, I think, have cottoned on to that. You know, a lot of, like, Refused, the International Noise Conspiracy kind of groups.
Even though the metal bands
like, yeah. Tuned and yeah. All that, Cult of Luna and stuff, and all that. Yeah. So their decision to sing in German, I think, is also quite a sincere one. You know, it kind of suggests that the aspirations are not commercial.
He also said in an interview that a lot of the songs are a bit like poetry as well, so we're much more articulate in our own language to be able to put across the ideas we want to put across, yeah, as opposed to pure garbled English.
Makes sense, you know? Aye.
That was Emu talking to Noise Attack scene. He's saying it's very meaningful for us to have the lyrics in German because we can't write deep lyrics in English. We don't have the typical style of a lot of punk acts who sing sex, drugs and alcohol. These songs are sometimes written like poems and you can't translate that into another language without it actually losing its sense.
Mm-hmm. Anybody that's done any kind of translation, like even when I was studying literature, like, that's a hard thing to do, because if you're trying to translate a poem, then you need to also translate the intention, and that's the hardest part.
Prose is actually a lot easier, isn't it? Yeah, the poetry part of it is difficult.
Even then, prose isn't even that much easier, because you need to reformulate how a sentence is constructed. So you have to put some of yourself and your own writing into it in order to make it make sense.
There's also just so many tricks, though, with poetry. And I mean that, like, in a positive way. Aye. You know, alliteration, the speed, the pacing, the way that lines end abruptly and all that kind of thing, that can be very difficult.
Definitely.
When a language has a completely different structure, you know, the conjugation of verbs, for example, in the Latin languages, you know, right. You can't necessarily translate classic English poetry properly into a Latin language.
Or vice versa.
Yeah, or vice versa. Uh-huh. Now, Stoffel kind of backed that up, speaking to your Oxfanzine. By the way, Oxfanzine is a pretty good publication. I don't know what it's doing these days. It's probably long gone, but I liked it back in the day. He says, we choose to write the lyrics in German because that's simply our native language. And if you want to give something a 100% authenticity, you should do it in the language you've grown up with. A straight translation of German lyrics makes no sense because our language deals with different vocabularies and can't be translated one for one without distorting the whole meaning. In our early days, we never thought that somebody outside of Germany would give us any attention, so we didn't add translations to our lyrics. Nowadays, we should take care about this point, and I guess we'll append English explanations onto upcoming releases.
Have we done that? Do we know?
I don't know, because certainly for the album we're going to do, I could only find partial lyrics.
Yeah, and the lyrics that are on their website are all in German. There is no alternate translation.
Yeah, that's
right. They're on their website in one big massive block of text, so you don't actually know what records they're from. They're just all, like, I know from the most recent record, they're definitely not there. I don't think can't remember, I might be wrong, but I don't even think there's any from Tans, Grozny Tans on it.
The Tans you can find on a couple of the other kind of independent lyric sites.
But it's like, here's a bunch of lyrics for some of our one many songs.
It's like, you know those fridge magnets you get that are just words and you break them up and then form sentences.
But yeah, they've got the titles in bold and caps, but like it ends like they're on the same line as the end of the last lyric, so they like literally all run together in one big massive bold block of text.
Good luck with that.
In terms of the lyrical content and the band's, we would call it an agenda, Stoffel again to Oxfanzine, he was asked about their lyrics being uncompromising and attacking, and he answered that, I don't find their content to be exclusively uncompromising or necessarily offensive. Sometimes in retrospect I almost wish that I had added a touch more nihilism to one or another text, or that my misanthropic side had a greater scope in order to give more weight to the thoughts I put on paper, but ultimately it just depends on the topic at hand and my emotional state. Incidentally, I think that aggressive prose does not automatically have to be accompanied by brutal sounds. It can also stand on its own, detached from that musical framework, and have no less intense of an impact. Mark, I'm sure you'd agree with that.
Morrissey's lyrics.
Aye.
I mean, Janice Smith's especially. Aye.
Yeah, that's true. Aye.
Take them out of context, you'd think you were fucking demented.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But apart from that, we see our texts more as comments on certain things, which result from a very personal point of view and free from any absolutes when it comes to truth or claims for change. This is a part of the band that I actually have grown to like as well. They seem refreshingly clear-headed when it comes to getting wrapped up in absolute truths, absolutism, kind of purity tests. They seem quite relaxed about interpretations. There's not too much virtue signalling goes on. There's not too much in the, I think I broadly agree with their politics from what I've seen of it, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of like,
you don't seem to get
extreme stances on whatever subject.
Yeah,
grandstanding or soapbox standing.
Aye, aye, and that kind of fundamentalist sort of like Puritanism.
It's interesting because you would automatically assume that a band who have the politics that they have, which is quite clearly anarchist, because they're still from squats, right? They're not wearing that so much on their sleeves as maybe some of their peers, like Crass, not a peer, but somebody that's quite similar to them, and ethos.
A forefather, have done, I would say, yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Which is just setting yourself up for a fall. I think you know, if you've got extreme views on either side, you know what I mean? It's like, prime examples, the Extreme Noise Terror, they've got a song called Murder that they fucking recorded in like 1987. It's about against eating meat. Murder! Now all the guys that in fucking Extreme Noise Terror eat meat, and that's because I know a couple of the guys, and I says, why do you not play Murder anymore? And he was like, yeah, well, you know, Dean eats meat. And I was like, oh fuck, right. So you kind of fuck yourself up when you put your, you know, you put your flag up there, and then you go, oh shit.
Absolutely. I absolutely, being too absolutist is, it can be a huge fucking drawback. It can be quite off-putting as well, you know.
Exactly. I mean, it's like Ian MacKay with the whole straight edge thing in it. And he's like, that wasn't meant to be guidelines. That was just his interpretation of how he lived his life.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then people just took that and made it a rigid set of rules. And then, I mean, I don't know too many folk that have, you know, I know plenty of people that
kept their edge.
But started off the most militant. Yeah. And you just look like a complete arsehole when you fucking fall away from it.
Mm. I mean, I think one thing that's nice about these guys is, yeah, like, their conduct speaks volumes. Like, the way they do business, the way they release records, the way they record, the people they work with, all these things we're saying about, you know, singing in German, what we'll tell you as we go on about the labels that they do. They're kind of walking the walk, and the lyrics, at least the ones that we know, are not so heavy-handed, they're not so sanctimonious. There's another interview that then challenges them on the risk of, are you preaching to the converted? Which is another thing about, you know, left-wing punk rock music, is that it's, you know,
aye,
people telling people, and everybody in the room nodding in agreement, aye. Yeah. Stoffel says, I think I would quickly become frustrated and disillusioned if I had the intention of converting the visitors to our concerts or changing the world as a whole. Anyway, where would you start? Ultimately, the differences between the punk scene and the part of society from which it wants to distance itself are marginal at best. I love that sentence, so I'm just going to say that sentence again. Ultimately, the differences between the punk scene and the part of society from which it wants to distance itself are marginal at best.
Aye, totally.
Here too, subtle fascisms are produced, witch hunts take place, the Roman bread and circuses principle applies. That's fucking music to my ears, honestly, to hear musicians that are politically engaged acknowledging how counterproductive that kind of level of dogmatism can be.
Aye. Also, not, he also acknowledges how it's fundamentally quite a limited tool for I guess quote unquote propaganda, whatever you take that to mean, you know.
He finishes that thought by saying, basically, we are interested in the personal development of the individual, and it doesn't matter which elite subculture you belong to. I like that juxtaposition of elite and subculture. I don't know if that's just an accident of language and translation, but it works quite nicely. The starting point lies solely with yourself, and the next level that can be achieved would be your immediate environment, that which you can influence. So it's nice. It's like a narrow focus. It's like, just work on yourself.
Aye.
Do it right yourself.
You fix yourself before you try to fix somebody else. Do you know what I mean?
It's a really refreshing attitude.
It's quite an anarchist attitude to have as well, you know, because it's like, the collective is only as strong as the people that are in it.
It is, and it isn't, though, man, because, I mean, a lot of anarchism can be quite proselytising.
Yeah, but a lot of people that run squats and do them successfully for years need to be quite pragmatic and clear-headed about.
Yeah, that's true.
About
they also need to try to be quite inclusive, you know? Because a lot of the people coming through your door will have different opinions. And I think, you know, as you can probably tell from that, their take on grindcore and modern punk is quite refreshing. So Stoffel in Noise magazine, the magazine had asked them, Grind and Crust have reached bigger labels, and they use examples of Nozum, Regurgitate, Disfear, Brutal Truth, for example, but they managed to hold alive an underground hardcore. Do you agree with this? And Stoffel replies, we already shared the stage with all the bands you'd mentioned, and I absolutely can confirm that they are still pure, inverted commas. I just think that some general aspects became more professional, but that's fine with me. Some of these bands are managing a perfect balancing act between being underground and using professional structures. Actually, it's the best way, if you ask me.
Does make sense. I mean, they're taking advantage of the bigger labels being able to put the name out there. Do you know what I mean? Whereas obviously your cops say don't do that, but that's a choice. They probably could get signed to an E-rate or a, you know, somebody like that, or a Century Media. Or,
you would think, you know, so when you hear it.
A Relapse, even, you know, yeah. they would suck that up, no problem. But they've obviously not done that because they don't feel that they need to.
And it's also nice that they haven't adopted that kind of holier than thou sort of.
I like they're dicks.
We're, you're out the club, sellouts.
No, yeah. They just seem like, you were saying, they just seem like level-headed dudes. They seem to just play music because they love playing music. Mm. That's the kind of vibe I get for the interviews.
The thing that sticks in my mind when, you know, when we're having this discussion is that they've already professed a love for major acts as well. And all, if you're going to be like one of these bands which is very much like anti-corporate and anti-commercial, like Super, and really into that, and your message is all that, then you need to kind of leave the liking of those kind of acts behind as well.
But that shows how, I agree, yeah. It shows how unpretentious they seem to be.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
like you know, name checking Weezer and doing a fucking doing a Cure cover. You know,
spoiler
what I mean?
Alert.
Aye, you know what I mean?
But, they cover worse than Weezer.
Yeah.
In terms of but I mean, I like that though, because I mean, there's nothing worse than a pretentious music fan. Like, I mean, we were kind of talking on that chat back and forth. I mean, I was, you know, we were sharing like fucking Kiss and shit like that, and it's like, but you'll get a lot of people that will be like, I'm a hardcore guy. So I mean, I know folk like that. They're like, I don't like anything but old, like hardcore for like 1981 to 1984. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, mate, come on, fuck. Seriously, that's, you don't like any other music.
Hypocrisy is the worst, right? But setting yourself up with that extreme set of demands.
Absolutely.
And constraints,
it's just silly. It
makes your life such hard fucking work. It's
aye.
Like, wait, what if your tastes change, you know?
Your tastes and
they do.
Aye, yeah. And music, I mean, I think anybody that says they only like one style of music is fucking lying to themselves, man. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah. Who the fuck wants to listen to Nozum 24 hours a day? I mean, there's a time and a place for it, but I'm not going to do it. Do you know what I mean?
So Ox fanzine, speaking to Stoffel, asked him, in the song Mero Cosmos, you talk about the code of conduct in the hardcore punk scene. You question the ideological establishment of a complex system of taboos and rules rather than real freedom. How important is this to you? This kind of refers back to him talking about how little fascisms can spring up, I think, within even just the punk scene, the left-wing punk scene. And he replies, we still feel connected to the fragile corpse called punk, inverted commas, in that we were decisively influenced and socialised by it in our early youth. However, for everyone in favour of this culture, at some point there should be a personal separation from, I would call it, conservative values that every movement inevitably brings with it, followed by an individual development. So again, I think he's talking about how an ostensibly quite left-wing movement can end up with some quite 100%. Conservative ideals.
Absolutely.
It's like left-wing puritanism, you know, when it comes to...
It's extremes in the left, you know what I mean? You know
that's
I mean?
Not how I interpret what he says there.
It's not? Well, let me finish his thought and then come back to that. So he says, otherwise, in my opinion, it just takes on an anachronistic quality and runs counter to the original idea. Let's be honest, nostalgic, consumer-orientated retrospectacles such as Punk and Disorderly or events like Punk Am Ring are pure satire and do not differ in the slightest from the archaic, hedonistic character of the Wacken Festival. Punk is extremely socially acceptable these days in many forms, and when I think of the old Blitzkrieg classic Fresh from England at the same time, in brackets, the Sid t-shirt, the Clash badge, the Pistols poster, then I once again see no difference to the stoic everyday corpses that people so often rebel against. Now, yeah. I think the point transitions there. I think the second point is just about how unrebellious a lot of punk, how unthreatening, non-threatening a lot of punk actually is now. Yeah. But that first point, I personally, from that, felt it tied into that thing he was saying about be careful in very purist music circles because it can actually become deceptively conservative.
In its own way, yeah. Aye. Yep, aye.
No, I don't make that. I don't make that logical leap, but I think he's making the one consistent point there.
Okay.
From his point of view, the conservative is moving more towards what I guess is the centre, which is where a lot of commercial music sits. That's conservative to him. So when he talks about it being more conservative, and he just backs up by saying at the end there, well, these are all consumerist and they're all hedonistic, and that is like complete antithetical to what he and what his band stand for and the culture that he's a part of. Well, and I do agree with him though, like punks ceased to being political pretty much a year or two after I thought it was political, because by the time that I got into it, it hadn't been political for a while. Mm. You know what I mean? More body political, I suppose you could say, when it comes to like women in relationships. It was that for a long time, and is no longer. So it's very easy for me to distance myself from the quote unquote political aspect of punk, because it's never really been the attraction for me.
Yeah.
And it's clear to him as well that perhaps that's also part of it, because he talks about bands like DRI and all that who were quote unquote political, but they would be more conservative than him. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So there is like there's a disconnect there between like the musical styling and the actual message, which is, I guess, why they're always a bit pragmatic about saying, well, we don't grandstand in our music, or we're not always talking about political things or our ideals and ideology, because that could also come across as being inauthentic to them.
Okay.
You know, it's like, I think from everything you've said, it seems as though that they place value on authenticity of the person, and shouting about politics all the time is quite inauthentic anyway, because humans don't do that anyway.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Does that make any sense?
No, it makes sense to me, you never know.
Maybe we'll actually get to ask him if he replies to that Facebook message again. So
plus, politics is just one dimensional. If that's all your music's about, then it's, you know, it ceases to be have any impact when you do have anything really to say if all you're saying is the same thing over and over and over again. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's just pretty much actions speak louder than words in his part, and this band's part as well, is like they are not commercial, deliberately so. They've never made any attempts or overtures to become less than underground or more than underground.
Yep.
They've always just lived that because of the reasons that they've just said, you know, and that's congruent with who they seem to be.
Right.
You know, I think.
I mean, he makes one further point that I think is really interesting. When he was speaking to Noise magazine in 2009, they asked him, don't you feel alone? Because many bands in grind and crust scenes are talking about political issues, social issues, are giving themselves a rebel image, but won't ever refuse some capitalist modern comfort. I mean, the magazine's basically saying a lot of these bands are preaching this very extreme message, but then will quite happily, for example, sign a major label or play in a big festival. Yeah. And he says, I guess it depends on an individual case. I mean, a band like Chumbawamba gave the best proof at last. They never stopped presenting, living their own ideas and ideals, although they signed a contract with industry. They showed that it's possible to do a clever balancing act without being hypocritical. In my opinion, they are more true, inverted commas, and he says, strange word, I know, than many underground-based bands with artificial, battlesome slogans. I thought it was a really interesting reflection. I will maybe just use that to conclude this part of the show before we go into discography, but it's a really interesting name to drop into the mix there, is Chumbawamba. Because most people will know them from, I get knocked down, right? You know, the fucking like football fucking anthem, you know? I get knocked down! And they don't know that Chumbawamba were
anarchist punk band.
Radical left anarchist punk band. Uh-huh. Yeah. And yet they did this thing that was actually meant to be dead satirical and then had total breakthrough success. And Stoffel was saying that, you know, the way they did that to him was far more sincere and interesting and impactful than a lot of the posturing of some of the, you know, like ride or die fucking hardcore left wing political bands.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes back to what I said. It comes back to authenticity. He obviously sees them and their approach to it as being much more authentic than another band that will preach that message and then go and play Wacken and then, you know, take the free beers and get all the endorsements and stuff like that, but then still be, you know, singing about like how fuck a system, you know, which can, to some people, can seem inauthentic.
Singing against fossil fuel companies, you know, whilst engaged in a festival that probably does untold fucking environmental damage, all that kind of stuff, I think it's a good place to leave it, because we'll come back and we'll go through what is quite an entertaining discography.
It's a long discography, but it's also very brief.
It is, it's long, it's brief, but it's colourful.
That's colourful.
So yeah, join us for the next episode. Joe, any thoughts before we take a little toilet break?
No, I'm just enjoying the conversation, man. You guys are taking lead. It's good. I get to chill. I'm usually the guy that does most of the talking in mine, so it's good to listen to other folk.
Actually, you're going to be getting heavily roped into proceedings when we start pulling these songs apart.
Well, that's all right. Aye, that's cool. I've got my notes here. And really, really professional paper, as you can see.
Nice.
Right, see you shortly.
Nice one.
Bye.